case matter for consideration.
Calling case numbers A191400, 1404, 1405, 1406, in re the guardianship of Reds.
Counsel, you know the rules of appellate procedure. I also understand on this particular matter that there's going to be a split of time and that it's going to be seven and a half for appellant.
Thank you, yes.
All right, our marshal is aware of that and he will make note. When you're ready to proceed again, just approach the podium, indicate who you are and who you're speaking on behalf of.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Michael Boulette here on behalf of co-appellant Ashley Bunker in conjunction with the Indian Child Welfare Act Law Center. Your Honors, there's really two basic deficiencies in the court's guardianship order below, and I'll be addressing the first, and counsel for the band, Ms. McConkie-Green, will be addressing the second. The first and primary that really resolves this case at the outset is the absence of statutory authority to do what the court did. Minnesota's guardianship statutes stem from the Uniform Guardianship and Protective Proceedings Act, uniform state law adopted fairly broadly, but Minnesota has taken a very narrow and alternative approach. In lieu of broad jurisdiction in guardianship actions, Minnesota has limited guardianship actions to proceedings in which parents are deceased and all parental rights have been terminated.
Did you raise this issue before the district court counsel?
Your Honor, we did not have the ability to raise this issue before the district court. Because it hits at the court's subject matter jurisdiction, though we feel it is critical that the court address it here. The central flaw in what the court's done is maintain a guardianship over four children whose parents are not deceased and whose parental rights have not been terminated. Now, Judge Flory, as you pointed out, and it's very fair to say, this is an action tantamount to an absence of subject matter jurisdiction. And the most congruent authority for this court to consider is your 1985 decision in DMS, because DMS asked very similar questions, and to your point, Judge Flory, asked them in a context of an imperfect district court record, right? A record where what had been asserted by a parent were fairly narrow technical objections. And DMS, in DMS, the court recognized that by virtue of the unique nature of guardianship proceedings, by virtue of the fact that parents have unique and at that point public policy-oriented, now constitutional rights to the care, custody, and control of their children, it's not enough for the court to rule narrowly on procedural objections in a guardianship when brought by a parent. The court has an
this guardianship, there were four adoption decrees that granted all parental rights to the petitioners in those that contained language that those grants were as if those children had been born to them.
Correct.
So it seems to me the argument is then who are the parents? Is it AB, your client, or is it the deceased adoptive parents who had these decrees saying that they had all rights to these children as if they had been born to them?
I think that that's a way to frame the issue, Judge Flory. I think perhaps the more precise way to frame the issue here is AB a parent? Not is she the only parent, we're not contending she's the only parent, but is she a parent whose rights have not been terminated under the language of 524.5204? And she is. And we know that she is for a few reasons. First, while you're absolutely correctly citing the customary adoption decree, the customary adoption decree here doesn't terminate my client's rights.
Let's face it, what you're trying to say is there's a huge distinction between suspended parental rights and terminated parental rights, and I just don't see what do you think your strongest point is in saying that these are two different concepts?
I think they're two different concepts under both Minnesota law and under White Earth Band law, and I want to take those two individually. Under Minnesota law, we clearly recognize that suspension is different than termination, and we do that because under prior law, under prior statute, which you can turn to when interpreting any ambiguity that you find, we provided that guardianships could be entered when parental rights had been suspended or terminated. We removed the language or suspended, And now it is only that that guardianships can be put into place when parental rights have been terminated. So Minnesota has appreciated the difference between suspension and termination, and guardianship actions apply narrowly only where rights have been terminated or the parent is deceased. Parents, all parents are deceased. Under White Earth Band Law, which I will leave to Ms. McConkie-Green to speak to in more depth, there is a definite distinction between these two types of proceedings. Suspensions provide Ms. Bunker additional rights that she would not have had her rights been terminated, including the rights to contact, the rights to inherit, and most importantly in this case, and this is really critical here, the right to have her rights restored if the adoption fails. And failure of an adoption isn't just a technical term, it includes where the adoptive parents pass away. So she retained significant, meaningful rights to her children that didn't terminate that relationship completely.
But then, and again, this is a wider argument, but it goes to what Jim Flory is saying here in terms of these adoption decrees. We've reviewed the adoption decrees, and it seems as if this is, we're beyond where this is because there was no appeal of those adoption decrees.
And the adoption decrees didn't need to be appealed, Your Honor, in no small part because White Earth, as a matter of law, gave Ms. Bunker the right to return to seek reinstatement of her rights. I shouldn't say reinstatement, resumption of her rights, of previously suspended rights, upon the failure of the adoption, upon the passing of the adoptive parents. And that is the critical distinction here between suspension and termination that matters so greatly. She, right now you are approaching Ms. Bunker not as a parent whose rights have been suspended, as a rights manager, a parent who currently has her rights restored. She is, for all intents and purposes, as I stand before you today, a parent whose rights have been fully restored to her by the White Earth Tribal Court. That's the critical distinction here of a suspension that White Earth Band appreciates, that we can, and White Earth has the ability to, terminate parental rights. It did not do so here. Instead, it opted for a mechanism unique to White Earth law called a suspension that provides additional rights for Ms. Bunker to return to court and seek the resumption of her rights upon failure of that termination. And again, this is not just a unique quirk of White Earth Band law. It's a distinction that Minnesota has recognized by previously using the word suspension and removing that from the statute. So I can appreciate that the adoption decrees provided additional rights to the children's adoptive parents. They made those parents as much parents as Ms. Bunker, as the children's father. But it didn't operate to the derogation of Ms. Bunker's status. Uniquely,
her rights survived is what you are
exactly right
stating, and that regardless of what took place afterwards, her rights still survived.
Exactly right, and that's a deliberate design of White Earth statute. That's not a quirk. It's not a legal nicety. It is customary adoption. The purpose of customary adoption, as I understand it, is to provide this ability for children to have multiple parents, more than the two biological or adoptive parents they might otherwise have. And we do violence to that purpose if we treat Ms. Bunker as anything less than a parent. My time is up. I'll cede the remainder to Ms. McConkie-Green.
Thank you. If it pleases the court, I'm Rebecca McConkie-Green, again representing the White Earth Band of Chippewa on these proceedings. Would it be helpful to the court if I jumped in where Mr. Billette left off with the suspension versus termination of parental rights, or would you like me to move on?
If you could address that, please, on the distinction between the two or the your argument that there is no ambiguity there.
Certainly, Your Honor. Thank you. I don't believe that there is any ambiguity. I would ask you first to look at the White Earth Code and the fact that both termination of parental rights and suspension of parental rights are present in that code. They're used for very different purposes, and they have very different consequences and rights. Termination of parental rights under the White Earth Code is a much more severe measure. It is used in situations where children have suffered egregious harm, and it is intended to terminate the relationship between the child's and their parent. I would also, whereas suspension of parental rights is actually designed to preserve that the relationship, and as we discussed in the brief and pointed to an article where the former White Earth judge, Anita Finday, who wrote the statute, had gone out and consulted with tribal leadership and also the community, and the kind of recurrent concern that was raised by the community and leadership was that we cannot do this things the same way the state does. This is contrary to what White Earth people's beliefs are and their structure, and they needed something that was more reflective of that, and they didn't agree with the concept because of their culture of terminating the relationship between a child and their family that they were born into.
How do you mesh that then with the practical application of what has happened here? It would make no sense. So we're looking at the co-drafter's intent versus what really happens when you put that into play. And that so often happens with legislative statutes.
Sure.
And I'm talking about state law now, where something gets written and it makes no sense when you put it into play.
Well, the practical application, and I guess before I can go into that, if I could, there, I don't believe that there's ambiguity between the definition of termination and suspension. But the practical application, and Judge Finde would often talk to parents about this in court when their rights were being suspended, is that they are not terminating or removing the relationship permanently between the child and their parent, and they're not doing anything with the relationship between the child and their extended family. Instead, what they're doing is they're building a larger protection. They're building a larger family around this child to provide for them and protect them. And there's nothing inconsistent there. That is very consistent with the culture of the White Earth Band and with the long history of Indian people stepping in to take care of their children. So this is something that is very reflective. It may seem different to Minnesota practice, but to White Earth, this is the norm and how it should be, that we just add people to protect those children and to help those children. Did that answer your question?
Well, it does, but it just calls to mind, of course, that we're talking about family and in that generous spirit that we're all one versus the legal impact. And the distinction, of course, that, as you said, Judge Finde is talking to folks and saying, look, this doesn't take away your being as a parent. I used to say that to my CHIPS families, too. I mean, you're a parent, you're always a parent, but the legal implications come into play, and we have to pay heed to those legal implications because we need to have order and expectations.
Okay, if I may, when I was being taught family law, one of the things that I was taught was that parental rights are kind of like a bundle of sticks, and so there's, you know, many different things besides physical and legal custody, right? There's inheritance and relationship and things like that. What I would tell you is, you know, when we're looking at legally, how does this work? All that really happens with the suspension of parental rights is the legal and physical custody of the children is suspended from the parents until, and the judge used to say this to people too, until the children are 18 and then it's up to the children, right? So all of the other parental rights are staying in place. The legal and physical custody is suspended, and then under the code, when certain things happen, it can trigger this right of the parents to come back and try to get those things reinstated. So if none of those triggering events happen, the parents don't have the ability to do that. But if the adoption fails for some reason, as sadly in this case it did fairly shortly after the adoption, the parent has a right to come back and say, I've been working on rehabilitating myself. I want to be considered for custody of my children
again. But she didn't then. She did after the guardians moved to adopt the child. At least that's my understanding of the time.
No, that's not, if I may correct you on that issue. So, you know, first of all, I would ask the court to consider that when somebody has a right and should be notified and they're not notified, it's difficult to hold against them that they don't act a little bit faster because they have to figure out, first of all, that there's even something going on that they could respond to. And that happened for both the White Earth Band and I think for Ms. Bunker. Because we weren't notified of the guardianship proceedings, White Earth didn't realize that they could step in or should be stepping in to those proceedings.
How do we reconcile that with the White Earth Code that says the order for suspension had a provision in it that said she had no right to notice or standing to appear at any subsequent proceedings involving the children?
And while I don't think they expressly use and thank you for that question, while they don't expressly use the term standing in the code, they in fact create it by creating these events where if they occur, the parents can come back and request custody of their children back. So standing then would exist once the parents were deceased or if the adoption had failed for another reason. And I would tell you that when, for example, an adoption fails in White Earth Tribal Court, let's say through child protection proceedings, the court does then provide notice to the biological parents whose rights had been previously suspended that that had occurred, so they are aware that they can come back at that point. If that doesn't happen, of course, it's very hard for them to get the ball rolling for the reinstatement until they learn of that. Once Ms. Bunker did learn that the adoptive parents had passed away and that she had a right to come back in and seek reinstatement, she did do that. That was the first action that was filed.
That was 3 years later?
Yes, it was.
That's the first time she had any idea that...
I would ask you, Your Honor, to keep in mind that there's a very big difference between having kind of constructed knowledge in the community. That's never allowed as far as service. Service is specifically required when in these circumstances, and so she should have been notified of the guardianship proceedings so that she could have responded. But
the court that... So when the guardianship proceedings were initiated, somehow the parties that initiated it had an obligation to be aware of the tribal code that because the adoptive parents had been deceased, AB was entitled to notice, even though the order from the tribal court said she wasn't. That's really hard for me to follow that logic.
Okay.
And it expired, but answer Judge Flores' question.
Okay, thank you. And thank you for that question. So when we step back and look at when the parent of a child passes away, what are the possible outcomes that could happen? So the child protection system, if there was nothing in place, could have stepped in and filed child protection proceedings. That would have required notice to the tribe and the child's parents who are still alive. If there had been an adoption petition filed, as there eventually was, that would have required notice to the tribe and the child's parents, which would have let them know these people passed away and I can now step in and try to reinstate my rights. Or guardianship proceedings, which under Minnesota law are another type of foster care proceedings, when those were filed by the Gullards, there should have been notice to the tribe so that the tribe could step in and advocate to govern and protect its members, as it's always done, and there should have been notice to the parents at that point in time as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning again, Your Honors. Mark Fidler for the appellees, the Michael Gullard and Anita Gullard, and they are the guardians of the four Rett's children. I just wanted to clarify something. The tribe keeps saying over and over that this is a failed adoption. And I think if you submit to my clients or to the Linda Rett's or Michael Gullard, the deceased's, they would be shocked to hear the tribe talk about how they failed their children. There was no failure whatsoever in this adoption. They died, it was tragic, and they did exactly what the tribe wanted them to do. The order said, you take these children, care for them like flesh of your flesh, bone of your bone, as though you were born. They were born to you. And they did that. And Linda died, a month after the adoption decree was approved. Michael did what he was supposed to do as a parent. He made plans, he made provisions. He named Joey as a guardian. They went into court. So those are the wishes of the first adoptive parents. So I blatantly I can't stress enough, this was not a failed adoption.
What about the provision that Ms. McConkie-Green just argued, Mr. Fidler, that whether it was a failed adoption or not, and the adoptive parents died, and so therefore, AB, you know, her rights remain to participate.
Um, Had the Gullards not established guardianship after death, and had she found out about it, and I think she did know about the death, and that's, and the court should know that that she had visitation rights under the first adoption decree, and Judge Tilmany actually ordered my clients kind of step in the shoes of that initial adoption decree, so they are continuing to honor those visitation rights. So she had visitation rights all the way through. So she knew exactly what was going on with the health. She had every opportunity to file a petition for reinstatement upon their deaths, and she didn't. And what happened was they went into court and they established the guardianship. Now, one of the problems on appeal is that the tribe and the mother did not serve the children. And under the Benal Shepherd case, we think that failure to serve the children who are interested parties, and the probate code does not, unlike the juvenile code, Your Honor is familiar with that, it doesn't make any fine distinctions between party or participant or interested persons. Everybody who's got an interest in probate matters, banks, creditors, children, guardians, you know, they have their interested parties. The statute says so. Then the only question is whether they were adverse. And Benal Shepherd, unlike as argued by the appellants, didn't require actual prejudice. The case said there the guardian ad litem's position might be prejudiced. So here, where the Gullards had a very clear statement in their will of what they wanted, the court recognized that, that those wishes were of constitutional dimension or an import under Troxell. They were very clear about what was in the children's best interests, and the court presumed that the placement with them would be in their best interests. So the idea that the children were somehow indifferent to what was going on, hadn't stated a position, that just doesn't fit with the record. So we think that the they are adverse parties, and then the court's without jurisdiction to hear their appeal. Moving on, the appellants place great emphasis on the fact that Ms. Bunker's rights were not terminated by court order, relying on 524.5.204. And Judge Flory, I would point out that this wasn't argued in the district court. The district court made no findings on that issue. And I think the issue was waived just because of something as has subject matter dimensions doesn't mean the court has to hear it. That said, when you look at that statute, it's very interesting. There's subdivision A, the court may appoint a guardian for a minor if the court finds appointments in the best interest. Judge Tilmany found that. And both parents are deceased. Oh, well, both parents are deceased. They both died. And the statute frames it in the disjunctive. It doesn't require that all parents be deceased. And what the appellants are relying on is the fact that there is a biological parent out there who, in some mystical way, has pre-existing parental rights that were not terminated. I don't think you even need to go down that road, because the statute, if you want to address it, if you want to address the appeal, clearly gives you the judge authority to create a guardianship where both parents are deceased. Nobody would dispute that Linda and Michael were parents in every sense of the word. If that wasn't enough, look at the adoption code, our adoption code, 259.21. There's a definitional section. Parent means natural, oh, and there's that pesky or adoptive parents. The adoptive parents were the parents. They died. The court had authority to create the guardianship. The appellants also argued that the judge erred in not applying ICWA. And, you know, I differed with Judge Tillman on a lot of things, but in reviewing her order again here, she was very, very thorough in ticking off all the factors. So there's four factors. So the point is, ICWA doesn't apply to every single proceeding involving an Indian child. It's very specific. We talked in the last case about what Congress intended ICWA apply to. So there's foster care placement proceedings, termination proceedings, pre-adoptive proceedings, and adoptive placement proceedings. And the only issue below was whether this was a foster care placement proceeding as defined by 25 U.S.C. 1903, parent 1, little I. So the court very methodically ticked off those three main factors. One, are we removing an Indian child from its parent or Indian custodian? And the court found, well, no, when the children were removed from their parent when they died, there was no state actor with bad intentions who was misunderstanding Indian culture. I mean, all the concerns that gave rise to the Indian Child Welfare Act, those factors were just not present in this case. It was the tribe. So when you want to talk about when the children were removed, they were removed by the tribe 9 years ago, 2011. So did the court err in finding that the death of Linda and Michael somehow removed the children from Ms. Bunker upon their death? That's just a bridge too far. She also goes on and asks, she's just parsing out the language. A lawyer's got to love that, right? So you need a temporary placement in a foster home or institution or the home of a guardian. So yeah, they're the home of a guardian, but what's temporary about it? ICWA is designed for temporary proceedings. You know, more permanent cases, we've got termination of parental rights and adoption. But foster care, we're talking about temporary proceedings. And she said the order here was not temporary, it was permanent. She looks at the third test. You need to have an Indian parent who cannot have the child returned upon demand. And again, at least aside the question of who's the parent. So the parents were Linda and Michael, Linda and Michael. But the court then goes and breaks it down even further on two levels and says, well, arguably, Ms. Bunker couldn't have requested a return of the children because the statute, the White Earth statute, said that she was denied any right to notice or standing in any proceeding. And then she alternatively found that suspension and termination of the mother's rights were functionally equivalent. So we did raise that in our brief, that termination and suspension were basically talking about very comparable. There's no functional difference, because if you look at 259.59, effective adoption, it almost tracks word for word with the White Earth Code. Upon adoption, the adopted person shall become the legal child of the adopting persons, and they shall become the legal parents of the child with all the rights and duties between them of the birth parents and legitimate child. Same as the tribal code. After adoption, the birth parents are relieved of all parental responsibilities, same as the tribal code. No rights to property, same as the tribal code. And then But it does reserve, just like the tribal code, our statutes provide for a contact agreement that survives termination of parental rights. It survives adoption. So when you've got an adoption and contact agreement under state law, that's pretty much identical to what happens under the suspension under tribal law, where instead of terminating rights, what's reserved are two things, the right to contact and the right to reinstate upon failure of the adoption. So now the tribe argues that, this is just following ICWA, that 25 U.S.C. 1916 requires notice to her when an adoption decree is vacated or set aside. That's exactly what ICWA says. Well, that just never happened. The adoption decree was not vacated. They died. Vacated adoption would be like if the adoptive parents, they can't handle the children, the placement's not going well, they're acting out, it's too much, they vacate the adoption. If it's set aside for some kind of notice reasons, none of those conditions applied in this case. So where are we? We would ask, Your Honor, that the Court of Appeals affirm the order of Judge Tilmany and give the four Rett's children the permanency that they were promised back in 2011 by the tribal court. And 9 years down the road, I think it's a little late to be upsetting their permanency. Becker County went into their home and recommended adoption. They stated what the children wanted. The children themselves filed consents to adoption. They stated their wishes. So we think permanency has to mean something, and we'd ask that you affirm the decision of Judge Tilmany. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. McConkie-Green, I understand you're doing the rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor.
Without a time split.
I think it's important for me to jump into the other elements of a foster care placement, because ultimately...
I agree. And in doing that, do you agree that if this was not a foster care placement, then the notice provisions don't apply to the guardianship proceedings here?
I would concede that yes, but I believe very strongly that it is, in fact, a foster care placement.
Right, I'm not prejudging that.
Yeah.
I just want to know, it seems like whether it's foster care or not is issue determinative here. If it was a foster care placement, notice was required. If it's not, it was not required. Is it that simple?
Well, yes, except that if there wasn't a guardianship proceeding, there would have been something else that notice would
have
been required
under. We're not talking about that. There was a guardianship proceeding.
Yes.
So that's what we're talking about, whether this guardianship proceeding constitutes a foster care placement under ICWA, right?
I agree. Yes, it does. And yes, that is where the notice requirement comes through. So the first part of that is whether the children were removed. This court has recognized before that guardianship proceedings are foster care proceedings. The district court found, as the respondent state, that there weren't removal of the children, and instead the children's parents were removed from them because they passed away. And I want to point out, first of all, when I talk about that the adoption failed, I do not mean any respect to the adoptive parents, but they are not here. They did pass away, and so we have a situation where children are without that permanency, and that is the failure. If we were to construe the law to say that simply because this is a guardianship and not a situation where the children were directly removed from their parents, so if we didn't recognize continuing removal, or we didn't in the alternative, recognize the death of an adoptive parent as a removal, basically, under the Act, we would be segregating out a bunch of cases where Indian children did not have the protections of ICWA and their tribe in determining what was best for them going forward. And that is clearly not the intent of the Act. The Act is intended to be read broadly, and all throughout it has provisions encouraging the involvement of the tribe. Whether you look at this as a, because the original parents still retain parental rights, these are subsequent removals of the children from them and changes in placement, basically, that are occurring is one way that can look at it. And so if we were to say that, and this was discussed in the Human Services versus JG, which should be considered a not binding but a persuasive decision for the court to look at. They talk about that it's not, ICWA does not just apply to the initial removal of a child from their parent. Every single removal or placement of the child is part of ICWA and needs to follow the provisions of ICWA. And so additional removals and placements happen all the time in child protection proceedings. There are a presumption that kids are supposed to be with family, and so sometimes they are moved, not just in ICWA, but in other cases. Children are moved throughout cases, and I think in the state of Minnesota, there's about a 35% replacement rate of children. So if we were to look at the fact that at any given time in the state of Minnesota, there's upwards of 3,000 cases involving Indian children, and 35% of those per year change placement, we would be leaving thousands of children per year unprotected by an act that is clearly intended to protect them. So the removal, both whether you look at removal from the adoptive parents or removal from the original parents as being continuing, the children were still removed from the parents, and the act should still apply to that. Then with the issue of whether the children were temporarily placed in a foster home or in the home of a guardian and conservator, third-party custody cases, guardianship proceedings, and other types of custody, I would say even custody among parents, are in some respects permanent orders that are issued by the court, but they have a temporary basis in that they are not permanently severing any relationships of anybody, and there is ability to come back in and adjust those. And the probate code in Minnesota recognizes that. You can change the guardian, and that was also discussed in the decision, JG, while I haven't seen it discussed in Minnesota, that for the Indian Child Welfare Act, when they're talking about temporary placement versus permanent placement, they're talking about other types of placements versus termination of parental rights as being the permanent placement for that issue.
Time has expired.
Yes. Would you like me to stop or to continue?
Oh, yes. Judge Larkin has a question.
Okay.
Please answer.
Simply because this is about kids, and I feel like I know nothing about these kids. So the kids are between 10 and 16 years of age now?
I believe so, yes.
And they were removed from mother about 8 years ago? 2011?
I think 2011 was, I'm sorry that I don't know this off the top of my head.
What contact have the children had with biological mother during the years when they've been placed?
Well, I'm not entirely sure of the contact all throughout. Since my involvement in the case, there has been contact. Both the tribe and the mother of the children, the original mother, have pushed for contact. That has sometimes been difficult, but the district court and the tribal court have supported that there should be contact. If I can just add one additional thing to that.
Judge Flory also has a question, so perhaps that's what it is.
Okay.
It's different than Judge Larkin's question.
Okay. At issue here is not what permanency for the children should be.
I understand that.
Okay. It's whether the tribe should have been notified and involved.
So my question is there a provision in the tribal code that indicates that in order to, in a suspension of parental rights and a customary adoption, does the adoption decree need to have a provision that retains for the mother the right to seek reinstatement of her rights in order to preserve that ability?
I don't believe so. That's expressed in the code. And I would also tell you that when, you know, when we're talking about comparisons between...
That answered my question.
Oh,
I can
okay.
look at the code. I read in someone's brief that there was such a provision, and I'll check on that myself. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, I want to thank all of the attorneys that participated in this matter. The briefing was excellent. The arguments were very helpful. We understand the seriousness and the impact of these proceedings. The matters are submitted. We will issue a decision in the statutory time frame. Now, I do need to ask you if you'll clear the courtroom so we can bring students in. That would be appreciated, and you can take your discussions outside. Thank you. Yeah, they want to come in first to talk to them. You don't have to. I'm sure they'd welcome that.
Yeah,
knowing students, they want to talk to anybody.
Yeah.